It's time to hear from the Green Party with co-leader James Shaw.
Yes, it is. I had an interesting chat with Minister Shaw this morning on a variety of topics since 95's BFM election coverage has been suspended in order to coincide with the new election date of October 2017. Last week, the National Party released their border policy to protect New Zealand from COVID, and it included requiring international travellers to provide evidence of a negative COVID-19 test before getting on a plane, before arriiving in New Zealand, and compulsory contact tracing technologies to be used by agency employees, border facility workers, and district health board staff who treat or test patients. This was described by Green Party immigration spokesperson Gulriz Gahraman as deeply disappointing but unsurprising, to paraphrase. And I began by asking James, what is it about the plan that the Greens see as deeply disappointing?
Well, I guess the main part of it was this sort of rather fanciful idea that in order to travel to New Zealand, you have to have had proof that you're COVID-free before you even get on the flight at your origin. That is deeply impractical, and B, what's clear is that actually a number of people have picked up COVID en route and in the airports that they travel through. So, you know, my sense of it is that the National Party were kind of speaking to their core brand of seemed to be really tough, but it was largely a gesture rather than an actual workable policy idea, and that's, I think, what Gulriz was saying was so disappointing. The other part of course, is that the National Party have taken a very hard line against New Zealanders who live overseas, and it's not clear to me why they're cracking down on New Zealand citizens who don't happen to be in New Zealand at the moment, as opposed to those who do. I just sort of think they're playing to people's prejudices rather than to sort of say, hey, we're all members of one team.
Is there anything about the current plan as set out by the government that the Greens would like to see improved on or changed?
Oh, sure. I mean, there's a 1,000 small things that sort of collectively add up. And I think that actually, government ministers, the Prime Minister herself would say that, things aren't perfect and we're always looking for ways to improve them. We've sort of spoken before about things like the need to extend sick leave in order to ensure that people who, like, for example, the people who are working at the border, who are obviously far more exposed to the risk of picking it up, are able to take time off if they develop cold-like symptoms, rather than to kind of push through it, which is sort of the current incentive. We've talked a lot about Māori health inequalities and how they appear to be playing out or sort of exacerbated by the current system and so on. So my co-leader Marnima Davidson spoken about that. You know, it isn't a perfect system, right? I have to say, I think given that we've processed something like 40,000 people at the border over the course of the last 3 months, and you know, we've had one outbreak, it's managed to, however it's occurred in that period of time, I would say is actually a pretty successful regime.
Just on that extension of sick leave, the Green Party is calling for paid sick leave to increase from 5 to 10 days to keep everyone safe. What I'm particularly interested in with this is that in the news last week, there were reports of high schoolers dropping out of school in low decile areas in order to financially help their families who were burdened by COVID-19. Can you speak to how COVID-19 disproportionately affects people based on income and how this change of sick leave from 5 to 10 days could help alleviate this pressure and the inequality gap?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think that the pandemic has really sort of brought into very sharp relief a number of the inequalities that already existed in our economy and in our society. The one that you're pointing to directly is that, you know, people who are on low incomes aren't just on, you know, like a stable job with that happens to have a low salary. Many of them are working two jobs. They're working on highly variable contracts. They're often independent contractors who don't have a lot of job security. Those things have been built into their contracts rather than to have the companies that primarily employ them sort of manage some of that risk for them. So they are particularly exposed in the current situation economically, because, you know, if someone who is, maybe working two jobs or has, you know, is a contractor and something like that, if they find themselves in a situation where they develop cold-like symptoms, the protocol is that you stay home, right, and that you get tested and you stay home until you get the results of your test. So even if you think that it's highly unlikely that you have picked up COVID-19, we need to make absolutely sure because it's such a highly transmittable virus. If you've only got 5 days of sick leave and your employer says, well, you know, you've either used those or you're close to using those, the incentive then is for people to just pretend that they don't have a cold and not to follow the protocol, which of course increases the risk to everyone. So what we're saying is that actually we should call on paid sick leave to go from 5 to 10 days. That would still be at the lower end of the OECD, by the way. You know, so most countries have longer periods of time for that than that, and I would argue that it should be part of our public health response.
On the other side of the equation, is there a risk that the sick leave extension would affect small businesses?
There is, and like we're very conscious of that, but there, you know, and we would, you know, we've said that we're willing to sort of investigate how to smooth that for small businesses, given that, again, small businesses are the ones that are disproportionately affected by the economic downturn of COVID-19. But the point still stands that, other countries that also have very large small business sectors and are more productive and higher income than New Zealand also have longer periods of sick leave. So it's not like this is not a solved problem elsewhere in the world.
Segueing off the back of that, COVID-19 has caused huge financial stresses all across the board, but let's talk about a demographic who haven't benefited as much from the wage subsidy, which is students. Last week, Green MP Chloe Swarbrick spoke on this, saying that many students were seeing an increase in casual work, which creates ongoing instability. Why do you think the needs of students fell out of the conversation?
I don't think that they fell out of the conversation entirely, but I would agree with you that I think that the support mechanisms haven't been as robust as they otherwise would, and we've been saying for some time now that, you know, we need to support students better, and particularly given that you're seeing a large number of people displaced from the workforce, many of them will want to retrain and in order to get a new job doing something else as fast as possible. And so you're actually maybe looking at more people needing student support rather than fewer. Now, our go-to for this is a guaranteed minimum income that would include students of $325 a week no matter what. And frankly, I think that sort of principle of universality would resolve all of the issues that, you know, students find themselves up against over and over, and in particular in relation to the COVID-19 response.
On that universal basic income, where does the money for that come from? Would there be a tax, or would it be a redistribution of other funds?
So what we have also released our tax policy for this election, what we're proposing is a contribution from people who have $1 million in assets or more, and of 1% of those. So, you know, for example, if your total wealth was about $1.5 million, for the sake of argument, and that doesn't include any mortgages or anything like that, so it would have to be you, not the bank that owned the assets, then you'd contribute 1% of the $500,000 above $1 million. Now, our calculation, which has actually been worked out fairly conservatively, reckons that we could bring in between $8 and $9 billion worth of revenue ultimately over the course of that. And what we're proposing with this guaranteed minimum income would be well within that envelope.
Let's move on now to police checkpoints. So Green Party co-leader Marama Davidson has said that the Greens support iwi-led checkpoints with regard to COVID-19. First off, what's the difference between an iwi-led checkpoint and a police-led checkpoint in terms of protocol or location?
Well, actually, the one thing that you've got to commend the police for is the fact that they've been working with iwi to make sure that iwi have got the resources and actually have got, you know, effective protocols in place to kind of manage those. And I would also say that Māori health organisations have worked extremely rapidly to get these things up and running. And so, you know, I wouldn't say there's necessarily a discernible difference in the experience that people might have. But the way that I relate to it is a bit like saying, well, you've got a population here who are particularly vulnerable, and that's because of existing inequalities in the health system that disproportionately affect Māori. You know, people are acting to protect their most vulnerable citizens. It's not really all that different from an aged care home who put a ban on visitors during the COVID-19 pandemic because, you know, they're trying to protect a particularly vulnerable population.
That was James Shaw for the Green Party. The Wire.